The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at cooperadio.org.
Today, we talk to Chris Tollefson. Chris is one of the attorneys representing 15 youth from across Canada who launched a lawsuit against the federal government. The young plaintiffs allege that the Canadian government is causing dangerous levels of greenhouse gas emissions and that the government is responsible for climate-related harms that the youth are facing. However, the lawsuit is facing some setbacks. A federal court judge ruled last year that the youth must take their case to a higher court. Chris Tollefson shares with us just what this means for the climate lawsuit, why the judge made that decision, and the larger context of what has worked in the field of climate lawsuits. Here's Chris. Chris Tollefson, what a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Pleasure is mine.
Chris, tell me about this climate lawsuit. It's La Rose versus Her Majesty the Queen, and there were many folks concerned about the climate who wanted a different result. Can you tell me what this climate lawsuit is about?
Well, this lawsuit, as your listeners may remember, this lawsuit was launched in October of 2019 on the steps of the Art Gallery in Vancouver. And at that time, there was a large event with Greta and all of our young plaintiffs. And with that great launch, we moved forward and shortly were met with an application made by the Government of Canada to dismiss the case even before it went to trial. So this past October, we argued for 2 days in the federal court over that issue. And recently, the judge in the case has given his decision, and his decision is to grant Canada's motion to dismiss the case.
Chris, what was specifically the charge in this lawsuit?
Our claim was based on two grounds. The first was that the failure of Canada to address the climate issue in a way that would protect the rights and interests of all Canadians, but in particular these 15 young Canadians, that is in breach of their charter rights, their rights to be free from deprivations of their life, liberty, and security of the person, their right to equality under the law. And we also said that this case is a case which represents a failure by Canada to carry out its duty to protect the public resources, which we say their failure to act and in some ways their actions on this climate file have caused damage to. And we would say that would include things like the atmosphere, our coastal areas, and the permafrost. So the lawsuit is aimed at both of those arguments. And on both of those arguments, the judge said that in his view, it should not be allowed to go to trial.
So, Chris, there were 15 young people from 7 provinces and 1 territory who launched this lawsuit. And to my understanding, this lawsuit hinged on 2 sections of the charter, sections 7 and 15. Can you tell us a little more about those sections?
Sure. Those 2 sections are key sections, really, of the charter. They're provisions which are for the benefit of all Canadians. Section 7 arguably is the most important section of the Charter. It's certainly the broadest section in the Charter, and it protects us from state action, or in this case, we would say inaction, that deprives us of life, of our liberty, or of our security of the person. And we would say that here there are demonstrable impacts in terms of the health and well-being and physical and mental integrity of these plaintiffs. And so we say we've met that test, and that the case should be allowed to proceed under Section 7. For these young people as well, we say that generationally, they are being discriminated against. They're not being given equal treatment under the law because the actions today will have significantly graver consequences for them because they will be around much longer than some of us, including myself. And so that we should be making decisions mindful of the fact that they have that generational difference, that they will bear the price for our failure to act.
So, Chris, this lawsuit went to the federal court on October of 2020, and it was dismissed by the federal court judge. On this basis, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the lawsuit is not justiciable, meaning, and in plain English, that the courts shouldn't deal with this issue because it's a political issue. Can you unspool that for us a little more?
Sure. So that this is a doctrine, the doctrine of justiciability is a doctrine which aims to make sure that courts do not take on cases that are beyond their competence or that would undermine the separation of powers, that would basically take them into an area that is exclusively within the jurisdiction of Parliament or the executive branch, that is to say, cabinet. So we actually don't have a political questions doctrine. Sometimes people confuse the two. We say that the question that we're bringing forward may be political in nature, but yet if it has a significant legal component, which we say this case most certainly does, even if it has controversial or complicated or political aspects to it, it's the job of the courts to deal with those political questions, to address that, to deal with that legal component, and to do so in a way that makes sure that the other branches of government are held properly to account.
Chris, I know there are many people in Canada concerned about the climate who have loved to see a different result for this lawsuit, but let me play the devil's advocate for a little bit, because what the judge said was that this case is not justiciable, that this case should not be handled by the courts because it's something that elected representatives should decide on. What do you say to people who have that belief that courts should not decide on these matters and that they should be left to elected representatives?
Yeah, well, I do think that, and I think the lawsuit is sensitive to this concern. We're not inviting the court to dictate climate policy, to suddenly step into the shoes of the cabinet or parliament in terms of deciding how we need to grapple with this emergency that we're facing. But we do say that in a situation such as this, where for 20 or 30 years now, the government of Canada has dropped the ball, has failed to fulfill its promises to deal with this emergency, and we're at a crisis, we're at an absolutely critical moment. We say at that point, and where charter rights are being jeopardized and impaired, we say at that point, surely the court must have some kind of role. And we say the role that the court has here is to decide this legal question. Have these charter rights been violated? That's their job to decide. And is the public trust duty that falls on the federal government here, is that also being violated? And so what would flow from a finding on those questions is up to the court. And I think the court is, in our case, being asked to grant a remedy that would be very much respectful of the expertise and the democratic role that both of those other arms of government possess.
Dig into this more with me, Chris, because there are many issues that many people would say should stay out of the courts and should only be in the realm of decisions made by elected politicians. I'm thinking about in very important issues such as the rights of sex workers or the rights of substance users. Again, very important issues, but there are many people who would disagree with that being in the hands of the judiciary. What do you think? Are there issues that shouldn't be decided by the courts?
Well, I think I would frame the question a little differently. I would say that there is no area of human life that should be off limits to the courts. In terms of carrying out its proper role, the role that we give it. If in any area of human activity, whether it's sex work or it's end of life rules, it's health policy, climate policy, the courts can and should have a role to play, depending on the circumstances. And I think that the test ultimately is, does the lawsuit have a significant legal component? Is there a legal question there for the court to address and grapple with? Have the plaintiffs put forward a case that their, in this case, their charter rights have been violated? And we say the answer in this case is yes.
Can you help me understand this better, Chris? Because I'm still feeling a hesitation, or I can see the hesitation of other Canadians saying, you know, I really want climate action, and they understand the climate science and know that we have less than 10 years at this point to halve our emissions. But given that we need to keep the integrity of our institutions, we should not let these policy decisions get in the hands of people who are unelected.
Right.
Tell us more about your thoughts on that.
Well, I think that we don't disagree. I don't think any of the plaintiffs would disagree with that. They are all active in our democratic process. They all make their voices heard as best they can. Of course, they can't vote, so that's a difference. And
because
that may
younger
be
younger than the voting age.
Exactly. They may be, in some ways, have a better claim to be asking the court to weigh in on their behalf for that reason. So I think that the battle to save the climate here in this emergency, all it's all hands on deck. We should be working in every venue to try to make sure that Canada does its fair share to try to turn this around, and the courts have to be part of that. I would say now they're going to be careful about what role they take on. I think if the question that they're asked is a legal question, has there been a charter breach, for instance, that's a question that they're duty bound, in my view, to answer. Now, of course, what remedy flows from that, what they do as a result of supposing that they did find that the charter was breached, that also has to be respectful of the other branches of government. And the remedy that we're asking for here isn't a remedy that would install the court as the judge of what kind of climate policy we should have. What we're asking for is for the court to order government to come up with a plan that would properly grapple with this emergency and to stay on top of it to make sure, while we're in this critical moment, that to stay involved to make sure that that plan is developed as it is told to do so by the court.
Chris, I asked you a number of questions about the philosophical division between the judicial and legislative branches, the courts and the domain of elected politicians, but I want to understand about the reality of the situation. To what degree was the decision of the court, in your perspective, influenced by politics or influenced by the personalities or beliefs of people of the sitting judges?
You're not talking about LaRose now, are you?
Well, specifically in this lawsuit, in the context of this lawsuit.
I don't think it would be smart for a lawyer on a case to be speculating about those sorts of things. I think we have to take the judge's words at face value, and that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to, we're, as you know, we're bringing an appeal. and a court of appeal will look at his reasons and apply the proper legal principles and hear our arguments and hear Canada's arguments, and we'll see what happens.
All right, Chris, I want to ask you to speculate on that, but maybe you can walk us through the steps after this. So we took on October 2020, the case was taken to the federal court, and now there it's going to the federal court of appeal after. And what's the timeline for that? And what are the possible paths after the federal court of appeal?
Well, I think that in all likelihood, we will see the written arguments in this case filed by early summer. We are filing first because we're the appellants, and then Canada will file. And we're hoping to get on and have an oral hearing, whether that's going to be in person or on Zoom. I really don't know, but that we hope would happen in this fall. We think that, as we say, this case is about an emergency that's unfolding, and so it would, in our view, be entirely appropriate for this case to be heard as soon as possible. And okay. from there, you know, it's open for matters to be taken to the highest level, which is to the Supreme Court of Canada. But to do that, a party would have to get permission, would have to get leave from that court. But that's down the road.
All right. So it's written submissions to the Federal Court of Appeal by the summer, oral submissions hopefully by the fall, and then if that is successful, onto the Supreme Court of Canada.
Well, if it may not need to go to the Supreme Court of Canada. If we prevail, we would hope that if we prevail, then at that point, we would have our chance to move this forward to trial, that there wouldn't be any further delays by further appeals.
And if it goes to trial, how long does a lawsuit like that typically or could take?
This is not your ordinary lawsuit, as you've probably gathered, so it's difficult to predict. How long it would take to run a trial. Part of the uncertainty is a function of the fact that sometimes lawyers on both sides can agree on certain issues, and so that would reduce the amount of time it would take at a trial. We could zero in perhaps more quickly into the key issues that way. So it's a bit early to know.
Maybe give me a ballpark, Chris. Are we talking 1 year or are we talking 8?
Well, we would not want to have a lawsuit that went on so long that it would thwart the court's ability to render a decision that would address this emergency. So we're going to aim to move this case forward as fast as humanly possible.
Maybe, Chris, you can give me a little bit of the context of climate lawsuits. I understand that there have been about 1,000 climate lawsuits filed in about 24 countries, and most of them in the United States. And I've heard that this lawsuit, the counterpart in the American system, is the Juliana versus the United States lawsuit. What is the success rate, if we have that data on that, on climate lawsuits in general? And what does the Juliana versus the United States case teach us, or what lessons does that impart for us?
Well, I think the lessons from climate litigation are kind of still being learned. It still remains a fairly new area of litigation, but as you've mentioned, it's an area where more and more cases are being filed. And I think that one of the trends certainly is that courts are becoming much more conversant with and accepting of the science of climate law, which is to say that we don't battle so much anymore about whether there is an emergency or what the nature of the crisis is. We've moved, I think, beyond that. And even in this lawsuit, Canada has made many, many acknowledgments, factual acknowledgments, in terms of accepting things that our plaintiffs have pleaded. So we've moved on to a new generation where the issues become somewhat more complicated, such as, for instance, we've talked about what kind of remedy is appropriate that properly respects the separation of powers, that allows for scientists and for elected officials and for courts all to kind of play a proper role. I think that the if you're kind of trying to quantify it in terms of wins and losses, it's a very hard thing to do. I think that there are a lot of positive outcomes in litigation, but yeah, I think there still remains concerns around justiciability and other issues, and so. You know, we're in Canada. La Rose is part of a first generation, and we're hopeful that by going first, that we're going to make it easier for other cases that follow behind us.
Chris, my last question for you is: for folks who are supportive of this lawsuit, so folks who are not in a legal profession, regular folks, is there anything they can do to demonstrate support for this case, or is it off limits because it's part of the judicial system?
Oh, not at all. I think when this matter was going to the court, the federal court, one of our partners in this litigation, the David Suzuki Foundation, I thought put up a really nice wall on their website where people could post letters of support for the plaintiffs, encouraging them and supporting them as the matter moved forward to court. So certainly, I know David Suzuki Foundation and other partners in this will be, as we move forward to the next stage here, inviting the public to do likewise at the next stage. You know, of course, there's other ways. Obviously, these cases are resource intensive, and so people who want to support by making a charitable donation can also do that. But I think the plaintiffs do take a lot of as we go through this process, they do take a lot of support from and are very proud of the fact that the public seems to be behind them on this.
Chris, thank you so much for your time today. And I know we certainly look forward to seeing how this lawsuit will progress.
Well, it was a pleasure to talk to you today. Thanks very much.
That was Chris Tollefson. Chris is one of the attorneys representing 15 youth from across Canada who launched a lawsuit against the federal government. The youth alleged that the government is denying them their charter rights by not taking stronger climate action. And that's it for today. You're listening to The Pulse on CFRO, your super local morning news show here on Vancouver Court Radio 100.5 FM. I'm Tan Macy. And as always, please tell us what you think of the show. I'm at Macy at Court Radio. That's M-E-I-X-I at courtradio.org. Ciao. Take care.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.